you funny old-fashioned thing. Tara reached across and tried to hug Isabella again, but spilled some of her tea on her granny print skirt and gave up the attempt. None of us here worries our head over bourgeois conventions. That's enough, Tara, Michael said firmly, and then to divert her. Where is Benjamin, and how is he doing? Oh, Ben is my pride and joy, Tara took the bait. He just popped out for a few minutes. He had to go down to the school to hand in an essay. He's such a clever boy. He's taking his A-levels this year. Only 16, and his headmaster says he is the most brilliant, the cleverest child he has had in Ryham grammar for the last 10 years. All the girls adore him. He's so good-looking, Tara chattered on. And Isabella was relieved not to have to make conversation. Instead, she listened to the recital of her half-brother's virtues. Benjamin Garmer was one of the many reasons that Isabella felt uncomfortable in this other world in which her mother lived. So deep had been the disgrace and so poisonous the scandal that Tara had brought on the Courtney family that her name was never mentioned at Weltevreden. Nana had forbidden it. Only Michael had ever discussed it with her, and then in the most general terms. I'm sorry, Bella, I'm not going to repeat cruel rumour and hearsay. If you want that, you will have to go elsewhere. I'll only tell you the facts, and those are that when Tara left South Africa after Moses Garmer was arrested and imprisoned, no charges were ever brought against her and no proof was ever offered to implicate her in any criminal activity. But didn't Pater arrange it that way to protect the family reputation? Well, why don't you ask Pater himself? She had, indeed, tentatively broached the subject with her father, but Shaza, for once cold and aloof, had dismissed the inquiry. In an odd way, Isabella had been relieved by his refusal to talk about it. Isabella was honest enough to recognise her own cowardice. She didn't truly want to know the extent of her mother's guilt. Deep down, she didn't really want to know if her mother had indeed been a party to the notorious Guy Fawkes plot of her lover, Moses Garmer, to blow up the South African Houses of Parliament, the attempt which had resulted in the death of Isabella's grandfather, Tara's own father. Perhaps her mother was a traitor and a murderess, guilty of patricide. At the very least, she was certainly a blatant adulteress and a misogynist, which was a crime under South African law. And once again, Isabella wondered just what she was doing here. Suddenly, Tara's features brightened, and for an instant she recaptured a faint glimmer of her lost beauty. Ben, she cried. Look who have come to see us, Benjamin, your brother and sister. Isn't that nice? Isabella swiveled in her chair, and her half-brother stood in the doorway of the hotel lounge behind her. He had grown again in the year since last she had seen him, and obviously he had made that leap from puberty into manhood. "Hello, Benjamin," she cried too enthusiastically. And although he smiled, she sensed the reserve in him and saw the wariness in his dark eyes. Tara had not been completely prejudiced by her maternal instincts. Benjamin was indeed a fine-looking lad. His natural African grace had combined well with his mother's more delicate features. His skin had a coppery tone, and his hair was a neat woolly cap of tight dark curls. "Hello, Isabella." The South London accent on the tongue of this son of Africa startled her. She made no move to embrace him. From their very first meeting there had been a tacit agreement between them, no displays of simulated affection. They shook hands quickly, and then both stepped back. Before Isabella could think of anything further to say, Benjamin had turned to Michael. Now his smile was a flash of perfect teeth and the sparkle of dark eyes. "Mickey," he said, and he took two quick light steps to meet his older brother. They clasped each other around the shoulders. Isabella envied Michael that exceptional ability to evoke trust and liking in everybody around him. Benjamin seemed truly to accept him as a brother and a friend, without any of the reserve that he had showed towards Isabella. Soon all three of them, Tara, Ben, and Mickey, were chatting away with animation. Isabella felt herself excluded from their intimate little circle. At last, one of the black South African students crossed the lounge and spoke to Tara. She looked up in consternation and then glanced at her watch. "My goodness, thank you for reminding me, Nelson." She smiled up at the student. "We were having such a good natter that we completely forgot about the time." Tara jumped to her feet. "Come on, everybody. If we are going to go to Trafalgar Square, we'd better leave now." There was a general exodus from the lounge, And Isabella edged across to Michael. "What's all this about, Mickey? You seem to know what's going on. Fill me in." "Oh, there's a rally in Trafalgar Square."
"Oh, God, no. Not another one of those anti-apartheid jamborees. Why didn't you warn me?"
"It would have given you an excuse to duck out," Michael grinned at her. "Why didn't you come along?"
"No, thanks. I lived with that nonsense for the past 3 years, ever since Pater took over the embassy. What are you getting mixed up in that ridiculous business for?"
"It's my job, Bella, my sweeting. That's what I came to London for, to write about this ridiculous business, as you call it. Come with us."
"Why should I bother?"
"See the world from the other side of the fence for a change. You might find it refreshing. And to be with me. We could have fun together." She wavered uncertainly. Despite her disdain for the subject, she loved his company. They truly did have fun together. And with Ramon away, she was lonely. "Only if we ride on the top of the bus, not on the tube. You know I can never resist a bus ride." They were a party of 20 or so from the Lordi, including Nelson Litlaklonge, the South African student. Michael found a seat for her on the upper deck of the red bus, and then he and Nelson squeezed in beside her. Tara and Benjamin were in the seat directly in front of them, but they faced around to join in the laughter and the joking. The mood was gay and carefree, and despite herself, Isabella found she was indeed having fun. Michael was the centre of everything, and he and Nelson began to sing. They both had fine voices, and the others joined in with the chorus of "This is My Island in the Sun." Nelson could mimic Harry Belafonte to the life, and resembled him, except that the tone of his skin was lustrous charcoal. He and Michael had hit it off together from the beginning. When they climbed off the bus in front of the National Gallery, the demonstrators were already assembling on the open square beneath the tall column, and Michael made a joke about Nelson and Horatio. Everybody laughed, and they trooped across the road into the square, and the pigeons rose in fluttering clouds from around their feet. There was a temporary platform erected at the end of the square, directly in front of South Africa House, and an area had been roped off in which a few hundred demonstrators had already assembled. They joined the back ranks, and Tara produced a hand-drawn banner from her plastic shopping bag and held it aloft. "Apartheid is a crime against humanity." Isabella edged away from her and tried to pretend they were not related.
"She really doesn't mind making a spectacle of herself, does she?" she whispered to Michael, and he laughed.
"Well, that's the whole object of the exercise."
Nevertheless, Isabella did find it interesting to be part of this motley gathering. With distaste, she had viewed many others like it from the high windows of the ambassador's office across the road, but this gave her a totally new perspective. The crowd was good-natured and well-behaved. Four blue-uniformed bobbies stood by to see fair play and smiled in avuncular fashion when one of the speakers referred to London as a police state every bit as bad as Pretoria. To show her support and to dissociate herself from the remark, Isabella blew the nicest-looking copper a kiss, and his indulgent smile stretched into a delighted grin. The speeches from the platform droned on against the rumble of the traffic and the passing scarlet buses. Isabella had heard it all before, and so had the others in the crowd, to judge by their phlegm and apathy. The best laugh of the day came when a pigeon, wheeling high overhead, ejected a spurt of whitewash which hit the speaker of the moment fairly on his shiny bald pate, and Bella called out, "Fascist bird, agent of the racist Pretoria regime." The meeting ended with a vote on the motion that John Forster and his illegal regime should immediately resign and hand over power to the Democratic People's Government of South Africa. The motion was declared carried unanimously, and Michael remarked, "Which should make John Forster tremble in his boots." The meeting broke up more peaceably than a crowd from a football match. "Let's find a pub," Michael suggested. "All that toppling of fascist governments has made me thirsty."
"There is a good one in the Strand," Nelson Litlaklonge suggested.
"Lead the way," Michael encouraged him. When they bellied up to the bar counter, he bought the first round.
"Well," Isabella gave her judgment as she sipped her ginger beer, "that was a fair old waste of time. 200 little people spouting hot air aren't going to change anything."
"Don't be too sure of that." Michael wiped the froth off his upper lip with the back of his hand.
Maybe it's the first little ripple lapping at the foot of the dam wall. Soon that ripple could become a wavelet, and then a riptide, and finally a tidal wave.
Oh, nonsense, Mickey, Isabella dismissed the idea brusquely. South Africa's too strong, too rich. America and Britain have too much invested in her. They won't let us down.
They can't expect us to hand over our birthright to a pack of Marxist savages. She repeated the obvious truths that she had heard her father as ambassador voice so often over the last 3 years. She was discomforted by the acrimony and logic with which she was assailed by her mother and her half-brother, and by Nelson Litalongi and the 20 other coloured residents from the Lord Kitchener Hotel. It was not a happy experience. That evening, when she and Michael returned to Cadogan Square, she was shaken and subdued.
"They are so bitter and angry, Mickey," she lamented.
"It's the new wave, Bella. If we are to survive it, we should try to understand and come to terms with it."
"It's not as though they are badly treated. Just think about Nanny and Klonky and Hamid and all our people at Veldtevreden. I mean, Mickey, they're a damn sight better off than most of the whites living in this country."
"I know how you feel, Bella. You can drive yourself mad pondering on the rights and wrongs. But you've got to come back to one thing in the end. They are human beings just like us. Some of them a hell of a lot better and nicer. By what right, divine or infernal, can we prevent them sharing all that the country of our birth has to offer?"
"Well, that's very well in theory. But this afternoon they were talking about armed struggle. That means blowing women and children to pieces. That means blood and death, Mickey. Just like the Irish. How do you feel about that?"
"I don't know what I feel about that, Bella. Sometimes I feel, no, killing and maiming and burning are never justified. Then
at other times I feel, sure, why not? Man has been killing his fellow men for a million years to protect himself and his birthright. Pater, who rants and roars at the thought of an armed struggle in South Africa, is the same person who climbed into a hurricane in 1940 and went off to machine gun Ethiopians and Italians and Germans with galled abandon in defence of what he saw as his freedom. Nana, that stalwart of the rule of law and the sanctity of private property and defender of the free market system, was the one who nodded happily and murmured, quite right too, when she heard the news of the most appalling violence of all mankind's bloody and violent history, the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So how immoral and bloodthirsty are Tara and Benjamin and Nelson Litalongi compared to us and our own family? Who is right and who is wrong, Bella?"
"You've given me a terrible headache," Bella stood up. "I'm going to bed." The telephone woke her at 6 in the morning. And as she heard Ramon's voice, the dark shadow over her life evaporated.
"Darling, where are you?"
"Athens."
"Oh,"
her spirits plunged.
"I hoped you might be at Heathrow."
"I've been delayed. I will be here for at least 3 more days. Why don't you come across and join me?"
"To Athens?"
She was still half asleep.
"Yes, why not?
You can still catch the 10 o'clock flight on BEA. We could steal 3 days together. How about the Acropolis in the moonlight? We can get out to the islands, and there are some important people I would like you to meet."
"Oh, yes," she cried. "Why not? Give me your telephone number. I'll ring you back as soon as I have a seat on the plane."
All the lines to British European Airways reservations were busy, and she was running out of time, so Michael drove her out to Heathrow in the Mini and dropped her at the terminal entrance. "I'll wait until you get a confirmed reservation," he suggested.
"No, Mickey, you're a darling, but I won't have any trouble at this time of year. The holiday season is over. You go off to your interview and I'll call you at the flat when Ramon and I are on our way home."
As she walked into the terminal, she realised that she had been over-optimistic. Hordes of dejected and weary travellers blocked the aisles with their luggage. When she finally got to the head of the queue at the information desk, she was told that a wildcat strike by the French air traffic controllers had delayed all flights by up to 5 hours, and that the Athens flight was fully booked. She would have to join the waiting list, even for a seat in first class. She stood in another queue to use a public telephone and finally got through to Ramon at the number he had given her in Athens. He sounded as disappointed as she felt.
"I was looking forward to your arrival. I have lauded you to the skies to the people I want you to meet here."
"I'm not going to give up," she declared, "even if I have to sit here all day.